This court has never recognized absolute criminal immunity for any public official. Petitioner, however, claims that a former president has permanent criminal immunity for his official acts, unless he was first impeached and convicted. His novel theory would immunize former presidents for criminal liability for bribery, treason, sedition, murder, and here, conspiring to use fraud to overturn the results of an election and perpetuate himself in power.
Right. That's the plan. Thank you for spelling it out, counselor.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. We have got two guests and a whole lot to get to today.
Oh my goodness, so much today.
Yeah. For change, Donald Trump's criminal trial on charges related to cheating to win the 2016 presidential election continued on Thursday, even as more new criminal charges have been filed against those who tried to help him steal the 2020 presidential election. We will get to that in a bit, along with our latest green news report today from Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Hi, Desi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay. It's been a weird, busy day.
Long day already. Anyway, as to the charges Trump himself is facing for trying to steal the 2020 presidential election, as filed at the federal level by special counsel Jack Smith. His trial on those four criminal counts, as you may have heard, has been delayed now for months by the corrupted and packed right-wing U.S. Supreme Court majority, who decided that that trial must wait until they had a chance to weigh in on one of the most transparently absurd arguments that Trump is making in his own defense. Perhaps one of the most absurd arguments that anyone has ever made in their own defense. In the extraordinary oral argument at the U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday, a hearing that was set to last about an hour but ran almost 3 hours, questions about Donald Trump's claims that a president has absolute immunity from the criminal law were asked and answered by Donald Trump's attorney, John Sauer, and counselor to special counsel Jack Smith, Michael Dreeben. The high court's decision to hear Trump's case, which failed at both the trial court level and unanimously at the U.S. Court of Appeals in D.C., has delayed his federal criminal trial on this matter. Originally scheduled to begin in March, that trial is on pause until SCOTUS issues its opinion in this matter, and perhaps even longer, depending on what that opinion is. At this point, if they issue a quick ruling fully in favor of special counsel Jack Smith here, the trial could begin sometime around, well, maybe September, according to experts, and would likely continue through Election Day. If they issue a ruling mostly in favor of Smith while remanding certain questions back to the lower courts, it seems unlikely that this trial will happen, will even begin before Election Day. Given the court took this long to hear the case at all on their final day of oral arguments this term, it does appear that the court, featuring three justices selected by Trump himself, is not particularly concerned about the American public having a ruling in Trump's 2020 election interference case before the 2024 election actually happens. Though we will get thoughts on that from our experts today. As you know, Trump has long been claiming that U.S. presidents have absolute immunity from any and all crimes that they may have committed while serving as president. He has repeatedly said that presidents simply cannot serve effectively unless they have such immunity. Though nearly 250 years of presidents serving just fine without it would seem to suggest the opposite. At the same time, Trump has issued what appear to be thinly veiled threats that if the court does not confirm that presidents have total immunity, then a future president, whoever that might be, could decide to, for example, prosecute Joe Biden for unidentified crimes of some sort or another. During the arguments in the lower courts, Trump's attorney, John Sauer, when asked if a president should be immune from criminal charges, even if, for example, they were to order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate the president's political opponent, Sauer indicate that, yes, they should be immune for that crime unless the president was both impeached and convicted at that impeachment. Other than that, yeah, that was an official act as president, and he could not be held to account, even for murdering political opponents. That is the actual argument that got us to the Supreme Court today. The question that the Supremes decided to examine in Thursday's hearing was, quote, whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct they alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office? That resulted in colloquies like this one on Thursday between Justice Elena Kagan and Trump's attorney, John Sauer.
If a president sells nuclear secrets to a foreign adversary, is that immune?
That sounds like, similar to the bribery example, likely not immune. Now, if it's structured as an official act, he would have to be impeached and convicted first.
How about if a president orders the military to stage a coup?
That might well be an official act, and he would have to be, has to be impeached and convicted before he can be criminally prosecuted. But I emphasize to the court that—
Well, he's gone. Let's say this president who ordered the military to stage a coup. He's no longer president. He wasn't impeached. He couldn't be impeached. But he ordered the military to stage a coup, and you're saying that's an official act. That's immune.
I think it would depend on the circumstances whether it was an official act.
He was the president. He is the commander-in-chief. He talks to his generals all the time, and he told the generals, I don't feel like leaving office. I want to stage a coup. Is that immune?
If it's an official act, there needs to be impeachment and conviction beforehand.
Is it an official act?
If it's an official act, it's impeachment.
Is it an official act?
On the way you've described that hypothetical, it could well be. I just don't know. You'd have to.
That answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act. But that sure sounds bad, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds very bad.
Yeah, it sounds very bad. But that is the argument that Trump is making. And even if a majority of the court doesn't buy it, as it sounded to my ears anyway to be the case on Thursday, they could, as I understand it, instead of simply ruling against Trump, they could rule against him in general, but attempt to narrow the meaning of presidential immunity with certain tests that would require remanding the matter back to the lower courts for more hearings. That could, once again, then work their way back up through the appeals court and back to the U.S. Supreme Court. So even a so-called loss for Donald Trump in that regard would, in fact, be a win for him, as it would delay the case beyond Election Day, which, if he won it, would allow him to, yes, weaponize his own Justice Department to kill these federal charges against him entirely. Joining us now to at least try to make sense of Thursday's historic, if arguably, at least in my mind, ridiculous hearing at the nation's highest court are two longtime friends of the show and very smart former federal attorneys. Lisa Graves is now the executive director of TrueNorthResearch.org after formerly serving as deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Justice Department. She also served as a former chief counsel for nominations at the U.S. Senate and a former deputy chief for the Article III Judges Division of the U.S. Court System. And Randall D'Eliason is here as well. He now teaches at the George Washington University Law School in D.C. He is the former chief of the Fraud and Public Corruption Section at the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. He now blogs at sidebarsblog.com and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times, Washington Post, and elsewhere. Welcome back to both of you guys.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Okay.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. So, yeah, that was a lengthy hearing on Thursday morning, which sort of had me scratching my head at a whole bunch of places. I'll get your overall thoughts on where this is going, et cetera, in a bit. But allow me to start here. And I want to get thoughts from both of you on this, because I had trouble making sense of this. As noted, the question that the court decided to hear was, quote, whether and if so, to what extent does a former president enjoy presidential immunity from criminal prosecution for conduct alleged to involve official acts during his tenure in office. Now, Jack Smith's indictment in this case accuses Trump of things like organizing fake slates of electors, pressuring state officials and the DOJ and Mike Pence to help change the results of the election, and of course, directing supporters to the Capitol on January 6th. After instructing them to fight like hell or we won't have a country anymore. So never mind immunity for the moment. Randall Eliason, which parts of those acts that Trump is charged with involve official acts as president at all? Randall?
Well, that sort of depends on who you ask, I guess. John Sauer's attorneys seem to think that at least some of them might still be official acts. But even he conceded under questioning from Justice Barrett that a number of things alleged in the indictment would not be official. They'd be private. And so, even if it does come down to that kind of distinction, it seems like the court wants to try to draw some kind of distinction between official acts and private acts. And that's why it took the case, right? It's not comfortable with what the D.C. Circuit did, which is just kind of say there's no immunity, period. But even if they draw that distinction, it seems like 90% of this indictment could go forward because most of it can easily be dismissed as not official acts, but private acts of a candidate.
Which is what was so strange to me when they decided to take this case at all. Here was Justice Sonia Sotomayor seemingly trying to wrap her head around the same question.
I'm having a hard time thinking that creating false documents, that submitting false documents, that ordering the assassination of a rival, that accepting a bribe, and countless other laws that could be broken for personal gain, that anyone would say that it would be reasonable for a president or any public official to do that.
Lisa Graves, even the Trump-appointed Justice Amy Coney Barrett went through a list of things being charged here, and Sauer seemed to agree that, yeah, they were private acts, not, you know, official public acts. Your thoughts on what would be an official act here involved in anything that Trump is charged with here?
It is really an astonishing argument, in part because when you think about the duties of a president, which are, you know, to make treaties, to be, you know, can sign bills or veto bills, act as commander in chief, you know, those are in essence powers, but they're not the type of thing that's at issue in this case. What's at issue in this case is a set of conduct by this president to basically subvert our democracy through a variety of means, through trying to get these false electors, through trying to, you know, stop states from certifying, to trying to command or compel a state official to just come up with, you know, more than 10,000 votes that he needs. None of these are official acts. None of these would qualify for that very limited set of things. Mm-hmm. But even if somehow a president were engaged in quote an official act like appointing an ambassador, mm-hmm. He couldn't take a bribe in the process of doing it. So even within this notion of what isn't an official act, it just seems crazy that here we are with the U.S. Supreme Court basically delaying the prosecution of Donald Trump for a set of acts that are clearly outside the bounds of a commander-in-chief of the President of the United States, whose job is to care that the law is faithfully executed. It's the opposite. And the reason we're here is because it seems that at least four judges on that court, and that in my view is likely, you know, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, chose to take this case, chose to not just leave the case where it sat, you know, at the D.C. Circuit, where there was a unanimous decision that Trump's immunity claims were basically baseless, ridiculous, extraordinary, and not consistent with the law, and allow the trial to go forward. Now we have these justices who have been playing politics for a long time now, since Trump moved this court forward with some of these appointees, like in the Dobbs case. This court is playing politics here, where it has taken on this case. And when you hear these, some of these members, like Gorsuch, talk about it, they're supposedly concerned about some sort of different future of some hypothetical world rather than the case at hand, yeah, as they try to avoid the consequences of what's really at stake here.
And I'm going to get to some of those points, but I'm still sort of, you know, when the court came out, when they accepted this thing, when they said, okay, we'll hear it very soon, in 3 months down the line or whatever it was, and they raised the question that they were going to hear about these official acts, I thought, well, there's no, you know, the question of what is or isn't an official act didn't really even come up at all in the lower courts. Randall, didn't SCOTUS used to find a way to be as narrow as possible in their rulings and only decide a case as far as they needed to deal with this particular case at hand and then just stop? I mean, well, here they seem to be trying to solve all future cases. Justice Gorsuch, I think, even said something like, we're making a decision for the ages. Isn't that the opposite of what they used to do? Isn't that the opposite of so-called conservative justice?
Decision for the ages, right? Yes. I mean, I think in general, especially when you're talking about difficult constitutional questions like this, they try to decide it as narrowly as possible. And
they used to
leave questions that aren't raised in this case for another day, right? And that is certainly one way you could have easily resolved this case, is just to say, we don't have to decide now mm-hmm. all the parameters of presidential immunity. All we can say, whatever it is, this doesn't qualify, right?
Right.
These acts don't qualify, and we'll leave for another day in another case the question of whether there might be some other types of presidential acts that would be immune. But no, they clearly, at least four of them, do seem inclined to try to write something more sweeping here, out of the supposed fear about what might happen with future presidents.
In his opening remarks, Trump's attorney John Sauer suggested that the courts here would have a chilling effect on all presidents for all time.
If a president can be charged, put on trial, and imprisoned for his most controversial decisions as soon as he leaves office, that looming threat will distort the president's decision-making precisely when bold and fearless action is most needed. Every current president will face de facto blackmail and extortion by his political rivals while he is still in office. Could President George W. Bush have been sent to prison for obstructing an official proceeding or allegedly lying to Congress to induce war in Iraq? Could President Obama be charged with murder for killing U.S. citizens abroad by drone strike? Could President Biden someday be charged with unlawfully inducing immigrants to enter the country illegally for his border policies? The answer to all these questions is no.
Randall Eliason, I got to say, I don't have any real problem with any of that, even if the example about Biden is kind of ridiculous. You know the legal system better than I, but I think that there ought to be more criminal accountability for presidents and those sorts of things that he named there, and that the system itself, if they are not crimes, could hold up. Didn't Bush and Obama know that there might be legal ramifications for their actions that he mentioned there when they did those things?
Yes, of course. I mean, the response, the easiest response to his claim is that for nearly 250 years, that hasn't deterred presidents from taking bold, decisive action, because they've also been willing to recognize that they need to act in compliance with federal criminal law when they do act, and that they might be potentially accountable if they don't. So And he undercuts his own arguments in so many ways. I mean, on the one hand, he's saying there'd be this great chilling effect on all these presidents, even though it hasn't bothered any, you know, president in the past. On the other hand, he's saying, but of course, he could be prosecuted if he's impeached and removed. Well, there's a chilling effect. So why doesn't that undercut his whole argument? Because he is saying in some circumstances, well, maybe he could be actually criminally prosecuted. So there's this great deterrent. So the chilling argument doesn't make any sense to me. I thought the Michael Dreeben, former Assistant Solicitor General, Deputy Solicitor General, mm-hmm. Michael Dreeben, who argued for the government, his approach makes sense to me, which is we don't need a doctrine of immunity. What you do have is there are certain defenses that might apply in a criminal case that only the president could assert, like this public authority defense. You know, there might be situations where, like in the drone strike hypo, mm-hmm. where that couldn't be prosecuted because the president has this public authority to take military action as commander in chief. So there are legal defenses that maybe only the president could assert, but that's very different from saying they've got some kind of blanket immunity from all criminal prosecution.
And, you know, and I'm trying to be a grown up here, and I'm trying to give their argument the benefit of the doubt. But it is very difficult. Lisa, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson responded to the claim that presidents would be chilled from taking bold, necessary action if they had to worry about whether or not they might be breaking criminal laws. She said, however, she sees a bigger problem if presidents do believe that they do have absolute immunity, that it would actually encourage them to break the law.
If there's no threat of criminal prosecution, what prevents the president from just doing whatever he wants? You seem to be worried about the president being chilled. I think that we would have a really significant opposite problem if the president wasn't chilled. If someone with those kinds of powers, the most powerful person in the world, could go into office knowing that there would be no potential penalty for committing crimes, if the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office? We would have a worse problem than the problem of the president feeling constrained to follow the law while he's in office.
Seems kind of obvious to me. Lisa Graves, as noted, a lot of this just felt kind of ridiculous to me. Obviously, she's right about that. Is this really an issue before the highest court in the land? Is anything here really an issue? Am I missing something?
She was exactly right. I mean, I so appreciated when she asked that question because it was so on point. Our entire system of government is built on the notion that the president is not king, that the president has limits. In fact, the president's job is to follow the law, to uphold the Constitution, not to use the office as a vehicle for illegal activity, on the notion that he himself is the only person who could not be prosecuted for his actions. It really did feel like bizarro Superman world to have this argument. And there were a couple elements to it. Like, the actual merits of the argument were in some ways genuinely shocking. The claims made by John Sauer continue to be genuinely shocking, although I should not be shocked, because as Rolling Stone wrote last week, this is a guy who also defended monitoring women's periods in an effort to try to get rid of Planned Parenthood. Like, this is that guy is willing to basically make any argument for his client, no matter how repugnant that argument is, in my personal opinion. But it was repugnant also because you had Clarence Thomas sitting on that case, which we can talk about later, who had no business sitting on that case, who should not be allowed to sit on this case, given the role of his wife in trying to urge on this strategy of Donald Trump, and even personally help reach out to legislators in Wisconsin and Arizona to try to get, you know, to try to get them to help in this scheme. But beyond that, there were so many appalling things. Every time John Sauer tried to invoke George Washington as on his side, I literally had the reaction that George Washington would be turning in his grave if he knew he was being used by this sophist to protect this criminal, this person, Donald Trump, who engaged in an effort to subvert our very democracy. I wanted to say, you should wash your mouth out with soap for daring to invoke the first president who was asked to stay in office because he was so revered, but knew that he had to leave in order for us to have and secure an actual democracy with real elections and transitions in power. It is was one of this argument by Sauer and some of the claims put forward by Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh were utterly revolting.
There was a point where Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, sort of on the point of, you know, if presidents have immunity and have always had immunity and that the founders wanted them to have immunity, as Trump has been arguing, Ketanji Brown Jackson asked, then, you know, why did Gerald Ford issue a pardon to Richard Nixon? She literally said, what was that all about? I think because he wouldn't have actually needed one at all, I assume. Since presidents are immune, Randall Eliason, as an expert in the matter of bribery, I guess I should say, as an expert in the matter of prosecuting bribery, the point was raised that the federal bribery statute, for instance, specifically refers to the president. And Trump's attorney, as I understood it, seemed to be arguing that only laws that specifically say something like this statute applies to the president, that only statutes like that can be prosecuted, that every law would have to have something like that in it in order to apply to the president, that he's immune from everything else. Did I understand that argument correctly?
Yeah, especially Justice Kavanaugh seemed really interested in that idea, this clear statement rule, which is something basically conservatives have invented in recent years, that a law doesn't apply to the president unless it specifically says so. But as Michael Dreeben pointed out, that's actually not correct what Justice Gorsuch said about the bribery statute. The main federal bribery statute, 18 U.S.C. 201, does not name the president, but nobody thinks the president is immune from bribery. And this idea that a president would not think that general criminal laws against bribery, murder, extortion, you know, whatever, what the president would think those don't apply to him unless the statute explicitly says. And this includes the president. And so Congress is supposed to go back and rewrite every criminal statute where it wants it to apply to the president. And if it's not in there, it doesn't. I mean, it's just it's so contradictory to everything we always thought is kind of fundamental about the country, that no one's above the law, including the president. And if there's a criminal law that's written, it applies to the president like anybody else, unless there's some unique defense related to acting as commander in chief or something, you know, the type of thing, which clearly is not present here.
I feel like we all sound, you know, sort of incredulous about these arguments that were made. Randall, is there a legitimate question here? I know we're all treating this, and the court at least was treating this as a legitimate question for about 3 hours, but is there an actual defense here? If you were defending Donald Trump in this case, is there an argument to make?
Well, I don't, not in this case. Now, I think what the court, I don't think it's crazy that the court, or at least some members of the court, felt that they wanted to say something, they want to say something a little more nuanced than what the D.C. Circuit said, which is, you know, maybe there could be immunity in some cases for some core presidential acts as commander in chief, and we don't want it just that the final word out there to be there is no immunity ever. But you can't, when you look at the facts of this case, no. The only thing that I think remotely might be considered a quote unquote official act, if they decide to draw that kind of distinction, is the scheme to get Jeffrey Clark attorney general and have him help to overthrow it. You know, you could see possibly saying, okay, well, that's clearly an official presidential action. You're appointing someone to attorney general, right? So maybe you got to carve that out of the case, you know, but fine. I mean, it shouldn't be the case because as Dreeben explained, that it wasn't a legitimate appointment at all. It was part of a corrupt scheme. But okay, fine. You can take that little bit of evidence out, but the rest of the case can still go forward, and Jack Smith's prosecution would be fine.
And is it anything that couldn't wait until after the, on appeal rather than an interlocutory appeal that could be done afterwards to say that particular charge should not be applied to a president?
Yeah, I've heard some debate about that. I'd be interested what Lisa thinks about this. I think once the Supreme Court rules okay, here's the standard, right? Mm-hmm. And trial judge, you have to apply it, and maybe you've got to kick out some acts that are official. I don't think he gets to then appeal again pre-trial every evidentiary ruling that she makes, because now we're no longer saying you have a right not to go to trial at all. Now you're just talking about particular rulings on certain pieces of evidence, whether right. they come in or not. I think at that point, it just gets wrapped up in an appeal after a conviction like any other evidentiary ruling. Mm-hmm. I don't think he gets to take interlocutory appeals kind of in perpetuity every time she makes a decision about some particular bit of evidence. Once the court says mm-hmm. he can go to trial, but just certain parts of the evidence can't come in, then I think it's just treated like any other. That's the way the speech and debate clause is handled, for example.
Lisa, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, ideally, or in general, in normal circumstances, I think that would be the case. But I imagine that part of this official acts argument is designed to set up another appeal or an attempt to do an interlocutory appeal over what's an official act and what's not an official act for the purposes of the trial. But, you know, in general, you're exactly right. This should not stop that. But I think the challenge is that just by taking this case, first of all, this is a case where way back in December, this question was teed up as a potential question for the Supreme Court because of the time sensitivity of trying to get this matter resolved before this election, mm-hmm. not just before this election in a general sense, because the election, you know, people have, a general interest in knowing the results of this trial as they formulate their vote, but also in part because, you know, Trump, in essence, has indicated that if he would win, he would pardon everybody who's been convicted of the physical insurrection on January 6th and direct his attorney general to, you know, basically attack his enemies and certainly to would consider, you know, pardoning himself or somehow holding himself immune. But the fact is that the court didn't take the case back then. It waited until the February ruling. Mm-hmm. Then in the February ruling, put off the argument until April. Mm-hmm. Then in essence, put off the decision until May or June. And there's a limited time available for this trial to take place. And so really, I think for me, in terms of the lens on this story, is that this court has already put its thumb on the scale of justice by intervening in some ways they're trying to pretend like this is about some, as you said, some sort of future. But in fact, the purpose of this delay is to help Trump. And in that way, I think this court, you know, has engaged in just an astonishing disregard for the actual system of justice by taking on this case at this time and actually not really expediting it compared to other cases mm-hmm. where we've had crises like this, like U.S. versus Nixon.
Let me get both of your thoughts on this, and then because I've only got a few minutes left here, and I want to, of course, get both of your thoughts on how the court may move here and where this all goes. But just to press you on that point, Lisa, and then I'll get Randall's thoughts as well. You know, I would like to see a trial, obviously, held and completed before Election Day, personally, and it feels appropriate that it should happen that way and that the American people need that information before casting their vote and so forth. But should the court system be concerned about such things? You know, shouldn't they be concerned with assuring that every citizen gets the full measure of justice that they deserve, or in Trump's case, you know, that he can afford and so forth? Shouldn't that come first before some notion that, oh, we got to do this fast, even if it means the defendant here may lose some rights that he is entitled to?
I'll jump in and then I'll defer to my colleague here. But
go ahead.
You know, I genuinely think that, and I have, you know, when I was an intern in the district attorney's office, I was the only person calling the defendants, the accused, you know, mm-hmm. so it's not that I don't take seriously the rights of the accused, but this is a case where as the DC Circuit resoundingly found, Donald Trump's claims were without merit. He has been given process, and had this Supreme Court, four judges presumably on this court, not intervened to put this mm-hmm. case before oral argument, we would be 8 weeks potentially into that trial already. And I don't think that Donald Trump has alleged any miscarriage of justice, any legitimate criminal procedural, you know, foul worthy of this sort of intervention, rather than just letting the case proceed as planned and in accordance with 200 years of law.
Randall should speed in this case, speed before the election play any role in this case or any case?
I think it should in this case, and here's why. I mean, and only really in this kind of case, because normally I think you're right. The courts and the justice, some of the justices probably feel this way. It's like, look, the timing was not our fault. The case came to us when it came to us. The fact that it's running up on the election is not our fault, and we should just treat this in the ordinary course, and there's no reason for us to expedite it. And, you know, the Solicitor General, I mean, or the argument today, the government didn't expressly, you know, ask them to speed it up. I mean, they seem to be reluctant to make that argument explicitly. But I think the reason it is a legitimate argument here is that this is a unique situation where the defendant is going to potentially have the power to cancel his own prosecution if he wins a re-election. That's never happened before, right? So in this kind of set, I mean, the people have a right to have these charges heard and resolved. And in this unique situation, if he happens to win re-election, there's a likelihood that the case will never be tried at all. And given that reality, I think there is a good argument, a reasonable argument, that there is a reason to expedite, just like you expedited in Bush v. Gore when you had, you know, this deadline looming and it had to be resolved, and they did it in a day. I mean, they can act quickly if they want
to. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that anybody's rights get sacrificed. I mean, Donald Trump is getting all the process any defendant is due. And the fact that a court expedites a decision doesn't mean that it's a sloppy decision or that someone's rights aren't being honored. It just means they can move quickly when they see that there is a need to do that. And there really is here.
Good to know. Good to hear from you, too. Guys, it seems to me that, you know, this court always knew that they were going to send this back down for reconsideration at the lower courts. My opinion, it seems like why they were in no rush to put it on the calendar. They weren't worried about that clock, Randall. You know, as the put it as last oral argument of this term. So I want to get thoughts from both of you before we go. What do you see as the most likely outcome here? The scenario for when the court will issue their opinion, what it will be and what it will mean for Trump's attempted election theft trial at the federal level. Let's start with you, Randall.
Well, unfortunately, I think they're probably going to decide it at the end of the term. I mean, they what they should do is decide it in a couple of weeks, you know, and give us a decision early in May. But like you said, they haven't shown any inclination to act expeditiously so far. And so I guess there's really no reason to expect that they will now. So all the arguments I just made are falling on deaf ears. They don't care about whether it gets tried before the election day or not. And if they wait until the end of the term, so we get the decision late June, early July, then it's really becoming, you know, virtually impossible to finish the case before the election, I think. And in terms of the likely outcome, I think they're going to write something that makes a distinction between possible certain kinds of official acts might be entitled to immunity in some circumstances, and here's the rule. And now you, trial judge, you've got to decide whether that rule applies to any of the acts in this indictment. And then go forward from there.
Further delaying the entire matter. Lisa, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think this that the majority in this case is, in essence, the right-wing majority in this court is not acting expeditiously and seems to be content to do that. But there is actually a movement effort that's been launched called Justice Can't Wait, hashtag Justice Can't Wait, to really demand a speedy resolution of this case by at least May 20th, if not sooner. I think that, you know, the people have a right to speak out about this, about the need to have a resolution to allow this case to go forward, that that's profoundly in the public interest. In terms of the outcome of this case, I'm not sure what the court will rule, given that that there's no precedence that they find sacred anymore. There's no, in my view, there's no law that holds to this, at least four, if not, you know, five or six of the justices on the Supreme Court. I'm hoping that Justice Kagan and Justice Condi Brown Jackson and Justice Sotomayor, you know, can persuade Amy Coney Barrett and perhaps John Roberts to not allow this to be delayed further, to understand that this is actually a very clear-cut case, despite the, you know, the myriad of spin from John Sauer and the Trump team, and send it back down below. I don't know how hopeful I can be that Roberts, for example, would do the right thing given his track record. But the fact is that, you know, Donald Trump, in essence, they don't need him for their power. In fact, if they continue to delay in ways that help him, it only further besmirches this court, which has been operating under a cloud of suspicion and mistrust by the American people. And I think rightly so, given its conduct in Dobbs and the ethical scandals. So the best thing the court could do would be to resolve this quickly. And I hope people can join this effort on Justice Can't Wait, because justice can't wait. Justice delayed in this case would literally be justice denied.
Lisa Graves is the executive director of TrueNorthResearch.org. She also happens to be a former deputy assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice. You can find her work, of course, at TrueNorthResearch.org and on the Twitters at the Lisa Graves. Randall Eliason, you should sign up for his Substack newsletter at sidebarsblog.com. You can follow him on the Twitters at RD Eliason. And by the way, he's got a great op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, I believe. Why is the Supreme Court making an easy case related to January 6th rioters hard? That's the headline. It's about a whole different case that the Supreme Court heard just last week regarding Donald Trump. Anyway, hey, thanks, guys. Really appreciate your insight here, and I suspect we will have good reason to bother both of you frequently in the weeks and months to come. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a quick break here.
Lots to think about.
We will come back with more. Yes, more. Criminal charges unsealed on Wednesday against Trump allies for their attempts to, yes, help him steal the 2020 election, in this case in Arizona. And Desi Doyen is here with our latest Green News report. Grim, as always, of course, but with some really cool news, at least for those of us out here in California. That is all ahead still on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
I love you, Arizona.
Well, you know, I must be feeling really good about Arizona today if I'm willing to play that terrible song.
True.
Even though it's my mom's favorite for some reason. Anyway, welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Even as his trial on the federal level remains paused, accountability for Donald Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election continued nonetheless this week above and beyond those already charged in several states for having helped him in that effort. Shortly after we got off air from yesterday's broadcast, it was announced that an Arizona grand jury has indicted the disgraced and criminally indicted former president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and 16 others for their roles in the attempt to steal the election on behalf of Donald Trump. The new indictment released Wednesday names 11 Republican so-called fake electors who submitted fraudulent documents to Congress, falsely declaring that Donald Trump had won the state of Arizona in 2020. He didn't. They include the former state party chair, a 2022 U.S. Senate candidate, and two sitting state lawmakers who are all charged with 9 counts each of conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. The identities of 7 other defendants, including Giuliani and Meadows, were not immediately released because they had not yet been served with the documents, apparently. They were readily identifiable, however, based on descriptions of the defendants. Trump himself was not charged, at least not yet, but was referred as an unindicted co-conspirator in this particular case. With the indictments in Arizona now, it becomes the fourth state after Michigan, Georgia, and Nevada, where allies of the former president have been charged with crimes for using false claims about voter fraud related to the election. In Wisconsin, I should note, the state's Republican fake electors there settled a civil suit, along with the admission that their actions were part of an effort to reverse Joe Biden's victory in that state. Descriptions of other currently unnamed defendants above and beyond Giuliani and Meadows point to Mike Roman, who was Trump's director of Election Day operations, John Eastman, one of his lawyers, the one who helped devise the failed strategy to try to persuade Congress not to certify the election. Both Roman and Eastman, along with Giuliani and Meadows, are all also charged in the sprawling Georgia conspiracy prosecution. Also charged on Wednesday was Christina Bobb. That name sound familiar? She's the lawyer who worked with Rudy Giuliani, but also as a pretend reporter for some time for the right-wing One America news outlet covering the fake post-election forensic audit in Arizona. She has now been named by Donald Trump as the Republican National Committee's top so-called election integrity attorney.
How convenient.
Just to underscore that, the head of the RNC's Office for So-Called Election Security has now been charged with multiple counts of election fraud in Arizona.
Irony is dead.
The 11 people who have who had been nominated to be Arizona's Republican electors, they met in December of 2020 to sign a certificate saying that they were, quote, duly elected and qualified electors, claiming falsely that Trump carried the state. The document was later sent to Congress and the National Archives. Despite Biden having won Arizona in 2020 by more than 10,000 votes, as confirmed multiple times by both those post-election audits and some eight failed lawsuits filed in the state, one of them was filed by these 11 Republican electors. Their lawsuit, nonetheless, asked the judge to decertify the results that gave Biden his victory in Arizona, but the judge found that they had, quote, failed to provide the court with factual support for their extraordinary claims. And then days after that lawsuit was dismissed, the 11 participated in this certificate signing nonetheless. In Arizona, Mark Brnovich, the very partisan Republican predecessor to Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays, who narrowly won her election to the post in 2022. Yes, elections matter. She had conducted an investigation. I'm sorry, Brnovich had conducted an investigation of the 2020 election, but never looked into the fake electors. So as to the question as to why it took so long to bring these indictments, well, the answer is that the probe did not actually begin until after Mays took office at the beginning of last year. The Attorney General issued a video statement on Wednesday explaining the indictments.
We're here because justice demands an answer to the efforts that the defendants and other unindicted co-conspirators allegedly took to undermine the will of Arizona's voters during the 2020 presidential election. Whatever their reasoning was, the plot to violate the law must be answered for, and I was elected to uphold the law of this state. I understand for some of you today didn't come fast enough, and I know I'll be criticized by others for conducting this investigation at all. But as I have stated before and will say here again today, I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It's too important. After the general election on November 3rd, 2020, the defendants and other unindicted co-conspirators raised false claims of widespread voter fraud in Arizona to pressure elections officials to change the outcome of a transparent, free, and fair democratic election. Those efforts ultimately failed when officials stood firm, followed their statutory duties, and officially certified Arizona's election on November 30th, 2020. A state grand jury made up of everyday, regular Arizonans has now handed down felony indictments for all 11 Republican electors, as well as several others connected to this scheme. These charges include fraud, forgery, and conspiracy.
So the fake electors who are charged here include Kelly Ward. She was the state's GOP chair until early 2023, along with her husband, two state senators, Jake Hoffman, Anthony Kern, a whole bunch of other officials, Republican Party officials from around the state. And I won't be surprised if those folks actually see a trial before Donald Trump ever sees his for the very same thing in federal court, if he ever does at all, which is just one of the reasons why this year's election is so critical. His trial on related matters in Georgia, however, well, at this point, it could come sooner. We will see. All right. Busy day here, so no time for a break, Desi Doyen.
I know.
Let's get straight to it. Your latest Green News Report.
A little hard to understand on a cool April morning, but I guarantee you in the months to come, you're going to wish it was this cool.
National Weather Service warns summer 2024 will be hotter than usual. Power outages have surged in the U.S. along with extreme weather. Plus,
the state's energy grid has been fueled 100% or more by clean, renewable energy.
California hits renewable energy milestone.
All of those milestones, good and otherwise, straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Folks, when I think climate, I think jobs. I think union jobs, good-paying jobs don't require a college degree. In fact, construction of new factories has more than doubled in our administration. Meanwhile, Donald Trump still thinks windmills cause cancer.
Oh, like they don't. This is your Green News Report.
That's what he said.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I guess I should have been expecting this, but it's April. We're already getting warnings about summer.
Yes, we are. Buckle up. The National Weather Service forecast this week that summer 2024 will be hotter than usual in the U.S.
Great.
Bringing more intense drought, wildfires, and prolonged heat waves that threaten the reliability of the nation's electric grid.
Fantastic.
Potentially even hotter than last year's hottest summer on record. NOAA and the Centers for Disease Control this week also issued new color-coded heat forecasts and interactive tools detailing local heat risks and air quality to prepare Americans for this summer's extreme heat. Globally, a new report warned that 70% of workers around the world are now exposed to extreme heat risks. The report, released this week by the International Labor Organization, warns that excessive heat around the world now kills nearly 19,000 workers a year, and they warn those numbers are rising.
That, as Republican-controlled states around this country are passing laws that prevent local ordinances from protecting workers from the heat.
Here in the U.S., power outages are surging across the nation, with the U.S. electric grid under increasing strain as climate change increases the frequency and severity of extreme weather events. According to the new analysis from nonprofit data firm Climate Central, since 2001, storms and high winds were responsible for 80% of all power interruptions. And over just the last 10 years, power outages caused by severe storms increased by nearly 75%.
Bury the power lines.
Power outages during extreme heat waves are also increasingly deadly in the U.S., with the elderly, disabled, and low-income communities hardest hit. In politics, 25 Republican-controlled states this week sued in federal court to block the Environmental Protection Agency's new tailpipe standards, backed by U.S. automakers, that would cut passenger car emissions and pollution by 50% starting in 2027. The 25 Republican attorneys general claim that the new regulations are, quote, unworkable and unlawful.
They're unworkable, unlawful, Except the car companies are just fine with them?
Yes. But 22 states and 5 major cities, led by California, have intervened with a motion asserting that their citizens will be harmed if the EPA does not require reductions in harmful vehicle emissions.
Good.
The tailpipe emission standards are among several significant environmental policies enacted by President Biden, but a new CBS YouGov poll this week shows that most voters don't know about them. The poll found more than 75% of voters support the U.S. taking steps to address man-made climate change. More than half said climate change needs to be addressed right now, particularly those who have experienced extreme weather disasters. However, the poll shows that the vast majority of Americans have heard very little about Biden's sweeping climate policies in the media.
Because we have a terrible media.
But they do favor Biden's climate actions when they're told about them.
Go figure.
And finally, a renewable energy record in California. On most days since mid-March, the Golden State has generated 100% of its electricity demand with clean, renewable energy, for at least part, if not most of the day, thanks primarily to solar. And the state's growing fleet of batteries twice became its single largest source of power, eclipsing real-time production from all other sources of energy. Joanna Newman of nonprofit Environment America called it a sign of massive progress with much more to come.
The idea of getting all of our energy from clean, renewable energy felt like some fringe, far-fetched, futuristic notion. And today, it is our lived experience. California has the technical potential to meet all of its electricity needs 38 times over from solar alone.
Wow. That's cool. Thank you for that. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. And hey, tell someone about it. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
California.
Hey, Desi Doyen, remember when you were on the air with Mark Marano?
Yes.
Rush Limbaugh's climate denier,
oh,
whatever
yes.
he was.
Oh, yeah.
Calling solar energy a boutique energy?
Yeah, surprise, he was wrong.
That could never be used. What do you know? It's used to power like the entire state of California at this point. Anyway, thank
surprise.
You very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to our guest today, Randall Eliason of George Washington University Law School and Lisa Graves of True North Research, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. Hope we made it worth your while. If we did or if we didn't, you can drop by bradblog.com and let me know, where you can download all of our shows. And hey, while you're there, if you did appreciate the show, please feel free to click one of those donate buttons. We could really use your support around now, or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at The Brad Blog. I think that's it, right?
Yes.
That's it. We will see you next time. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.